So in Parshat Shlach, the main focus is clearly going to be on the so-called Meraglim, right? The people who go and they spy and they come back with an evil report. And as a result, or as a direct result, is probably more precise, as a direct result of this, the generation that leaves the desert, who ostensibly was supposed to, sorry, leave Egypt, ostensibly was supposed to go directly to the land of Israel, they end up not going to the land of Israel directly, and they end up wandering through the desert for the next 39 years, which means a trip which could have or should have been a relatively short trip ends up becoming a much longer trip. Now, one of the things which is interesting, specifically in Bamidbar, but I think is interesting for that matter, in various sections of the Torah, but Bamidbar presents its own challenge, is this interplay between law and narrative. Which means generally, whenever a law is introduced, we're intrigued as to why that particular law is introduced at this particular juncture. So, for example, the Book of Bereshit, which has very, very few laws, and for that matter, the Rambam is of the opinion that the laws which are there are not binding because they're there. Quite the opposite. He says all the laws are binding because God told those same laws to Moshe. So why are those laws interdispersed within the narrative of Bereshit? Because it must be that it's part of the narrative. So therefore, when man is told, let's just say, for example, Adam and Eve are told to procreate, peru or vu, that's part of the narrative. When certain laws are told to Noah after the flood, because that's part of the narrative. When Avram is told to do brit milah, to circumcision, that's part of the narrative. When Yaakov is told, in terms of the law of Gid HaNasheh, that's part of the narrative. And actually, that may be a later law which is put into the narrative at that particular juncture, because the law is connected to that particular narrative. So as I said, in Bereshit it becomes very, very easy. Shemot, it's a little more interesting, but even in Shemot, it's not that difficult to track why a particular law is at a particular place. Again, it's something that as you look at it, you generally have at least some kind of understanding, even though I will admit that parts of Shemot would be a little bit more difficult. When you get to Vayikra, you give up, for a very simple reason, because Vayikra has almost no narrative, only has two portions of narrative, and the rest of it's law. So it's not a question in Vayikra of trying to figure out why those laws are within that narrative. In Vayikra, the challenge is the opposite, is why is this narrative in the middle of the law which is being presented? When we get to Bamidbar, we once again have this really interesting, and by the way, more so than Shemot, and certainly more so in Bereshit, and completely different Vayikra, we essentially have narrative taking place, but we have lots of laws thrown in the middle. So we're not going to deal with the entire book right now, but what we will deal with are the laws which are introduced within this parasha, especially after the sin of the Meraglim. And we'll see how easy some of them are, but as far as to try to gain real insight, you'll give me a little bit of help, and then everything will hopefully make complete sense. We have the Meraglim themselves. We have after, you know, and that itself is divided into different parts. The initial speech, which is given, Kalev, the second speech, Kalev and Yeshua. We have the punishment, we have Moshe's prayer, we have finally this new group that decides they're going to go up, and that ends up in a disaster. And then we get up to Perek Tet Vav, and as I said, you're going to see how easy this is now. So anyone can do this. You can try this at home, it's fine. Perek Tet Vav. Vaydaber, do you want to stop me when it gets interesting, or I'll tell you. Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, God said to Moshe, saying, Daber o b'nei Israel, speak to the children of Israel, vamarta aleim and say to them, ki tavo ala eretz moshevotechem asher ani noten lechem. When you get to the land of your inhabitants, where you're going to settle, which I'm going to give you. Okay, that was the part which was interesting. Why is that interesting? Because even though we're stuck in the desert, we're going to be stuck for a long time, what is God now telling Moshe to do? Meaning, it's not that you're never going to get there. It's not that the trip to Israel is never going to happen. It's been delayed. And right away God says, okay, so now when you get to the land, here's the law that you're going to do when you get to the land. So I'm saying that's just a real interesting focus. Ki tavo el eretz moshevoteichem. When you get there. Va'asitem ishe la Hashem ola ozevach lefalei neder o minedava o b'moadeichem la'asot reyach nichoach la'ashem minabakar o minatzon. When you're going to bring the offering, and this offering is going to be either because it's obligatory or because it's a volunteer offering, it's an offering which is going to bring a reach nichoach. What is a reach nichoach? I mean, even though there's a literal sense to it, or a pleasant smell, I think it's also a metaphor, and that is it's going to bring about a proper response from God. God will readily accept the offering that you're giving. V'kriv ha-makriv korbanola Hashem in chatzolot v'yisorim b'lu b'rivi'atahin shamen v'yayin la'nesach rivi'itahin ta'aseh alola la'zavach la'keves echad. And with this whole section will continue to tell us now what the focus will be the introduction of wine into the korbanot. Which means this is the element which is really being added over here. This is the element which we were unaware of before, of how when the individual brings an offering, he needs to bring yayin as well, wine as well, as lenesach, which means the wine is going to be used as, perhaps the word would be a libation. And this is something which we were not familiar with before. Okay, so the first thing that we're keeping in mind is the wine for the korban yachid, the wine being introduced for the offering of the individual. In Pasuk Yud Zayin, you'll notice that it will continue again in a similar sense. Vayedaber Hashem Moshe le'emor, deber b'nei Yisrael, marti le'em bivoachem el ha'aretz asher ani mevi etchem shama. Now again, you can't miss the reference over here. When you come to the land which I will bring you there, which means not only do we have like we had, look at the last introduction. Right? In Pasuk Bet. Ki tavo el eretz moshevoteichem, when you're going to come into the land which you're going to settle by, asher ani noten lechem, which I'm going to give you. How is God active in Pasuk Bet? God is active only by saying, this is something I gave you. Now, why does God have to give it to us? Which is a very bad way of putting it. Why does God have to give it to us? Because he promised it. Who did he promise it to? He promised it all the way to Avraham. So over here, essentially what is being told in Pasuk Bet, I made a promise to Avram that I'm giving you something, so I'm going to keep my word and you're going to get the land. What's being added in Pasuk Yudchet? Daber b'nei Yisrael marteleim bivoachem el ha'aretz asher ani mevi etchem shama. I will bring, when you come to land, which I will bring you to this land. So again, what do I get when I look at these two sections together? And I don't know what the second section is yet. I really do know, but you don't know yet what the second section is. What am I getting so far? That after the sin of the spies, after the Jews have been told you're not going directly to the land, there could have been people who therefore would have been in despair, and people who would have said, forget about it, we're never going, and it's never going to happen. So immediately afterwards we have God coming and saying to Moshe, okay, here are some laws that I want taught. So when I see these laws, so two things interest me. One is the actual laws themselves, which we haven't paid attention to yet. The second thing which interests me is how these laws are being framed. So the framework that we see at this point is that when you come to the land which was promised to you, or the land which I promised to Avraham, which again, those words are not over here. I'm reading it into it. Or the second time when it says, the land which I will bring you to that land. So this tells me a couple of things. The promise between God and Abraham is going to be fulfilled with these people. And secondly, that not only that, but when God told to Moshe all those years before, I will take the people into the land, which by the way is not a simple point, especially after you, if you follow the whole dialogue after the sin of the golden calf, to what extent will God be involved in bringing the people into the land or leading them in? Over here, God says, the land, back in Pasuk Yudchet, Bivoachem Ela Aretz Asher Ani Mevi Etchem Shama, the land which I will lead you to. So I'm saying these two laws being introduced here must, on some level, have brought comfort to the people. This realization, we are going to the land, the promise is still going to be kept, and God is still going to take us in. And as I said, all that is not even knowing what the laws are. So, I mean, I could even say that that God says to teach these things for the simple reason to give these messages. And by the way, if I say it like that, the laws which you teach are irrelevant. I mean, the fact that we're still, the plan is still on, we're still continuing the conversation. Again, you know, you can imagine any relationship. You can imagine a marriage, any relationship that has, you know, some kind of trauma to it. And afterwards, okay, let's now continue our long-term plans. So that means, hold it, that means that there's still hope. Even though on a short-term level, there was clearly a problem, but the long-term plans are now being considered again. So that has to be a very powerful message, even, as I said, without paying attention to what is being discussed. This is being said to the same people. What you're pointing out is because you know the end of the story, so you know that these people are going to die out. Yes, and you even know that this week's parsha to these people are going to die out. All that's fine. This generation won't be here. Good. Is God still keeping the promise on a long-term basis that these people, when I say these people, the children of Israel will still go into the land of Israel? Yes. Which means it could have been that God just says, you know, forget about them, as he had kindly offered to do on a previous time. The second law which is introduced over here, as I said, we only have the introduction. Let's read it now all the way through. Deber Shem Moshe Lemor, Deber Obnei Yisrael, we're in Pasuk Yudchet. V'amarta aleihem, and say to them, B'vochem al aretz asher mivi etchem shama, Pasuk Yudchet, V'yaba achalchem milechem haaretz, tarimu truma laHashem. That when you eat from the bread of the land, you're going to give a gift to God. Reshit arisotechem chala, tarimu truma ketrumat goren ken tarimu ota. Me reshit arisotechem tenu lashem truma ledorotechem. This is the law which many of you are familiar with, which is a law which is called chala, separating chala from the dough. Chala. Here is where chala is introduced. First thing that you'll note is that challah is framed as a law which is connected to the land of Israel. I would assume that most of you who have baked outside the land of Israel have separated challah as well. There is a major debate as to why people do challah outside of the land of Israel. What exactly is it on a Torah level, is it on a rabbinic level, why this would be the case. But again, over here, it does clearly frame it at this particular point, it frames it as something that you will do when you get to the land. So the two things which are introduced is something having to do with korbanot, as an individual, to put wine on the korbanot. The second law which is introduced is challah, which is essentially a non-korban. It's in each person's home. On the other hand, it separates from something which is mundane, and it does focus on something which is holy. Which means, in both, and by the way, wine is something which can very easily be seen as something which is very unholy. And now you take from the wine and you use it in the Beit HaMikdash, so that here you have a focus of taking something which could be, you know, you can check out any bar, pub, or other places where the alcohol flows. So it's taking something which is perhaps essentially unholy and bringing it into the Beit HaMikdash and making it part of the Korban, making part of the offering. On the other hand, taking bread, which is something which is ostensibly very, very mundane, and then taking a separation from that and making this which is holy. So it's actually these two laws go in two different directions, but they may nonetheless have some type of a commonality to them, which is this interplay between holiness and the mundane, as I said, both in terms of wine and in terms of bread. Although that's not quite enough, because you all know also that wine and bread have other types of things which keep them or connect them with one another. You'll know that, for example, on Shabbat, the thing which will make that meal different from other meals will be the wine on the one hand and the bread on the other hand, which really, in a sense, start the meal. And there are other things about wine and bread, which over here is interesting. The third law, which is introduced, is different, because over here there's no framework in terms of when you get to the land, which automatically, therefore, makes it different. Although you may be tempted to tell me, nonetheless, why you think it's connected. The third law has to do with, let's take a look at Pasuk Kaf Bet, V'kitis guvelo ta'asut kol mitzvot ta'ela shediber Hashem Moshe. And what's that, what happens if you make a mistake? V'kitishgu, you make a shkaga, you make a mistake. Right? And you don't do all the commandments which God has commanded you. Et kol asher tiva Hashem aleichem, biyad Moshe, miyoma asher tiva Hashem v'halal dorotechem, for now and forever. V'yayim me'enei ha'ida ne'esta l'shkaga, if the eyes of the community, the leaders of the community, make a mistake, v'asu kol eida par ben bakar, echad lo l'alarech nechoach l'shem, and so on and so forth. Over here, v'nislach lehem ki shkaga hi, v'nislacha l'kol eida p'nei Yisrael, l'gir gar b'tocham, ki l'chol ha'am b'shkaga. It says, what happens if the leaders make a mistake in judgment, and then the entire nation follows forth and makes a mistake? The leaders then have an obligation of bringing an offering. This is just a very interesting law, and it's very interesting that it's placed over here. And as I said again, you may be very tempted over here in order to now read into this, why this is being presented at this particular juncture. The law goes like this. Let's say that I, as an individual, make a mistake in terms of the laws of Shabbat. And something which I think is allowed is really not allowed. And I do it on Shabbat. So during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, I would have to bring a korban shogeg. I broke Shabbat knowingly, willfully, except I did not know that this is the thing was not allowed. When I say knowingly and willfully, I don't mean that the breaking of Shabbat was, I intended to break Shabbat. I didn't intend to break Shabbat. But I intended to do this particular thing, which I thought was allowed. And it turns out it was not really allowed. Whatever. Completely made a mistake. I bring a korban. What if, and now I'll be extreme, what if the Beit Din made a mistake on this law, and the Beit Din, Paskin, that you're allowed to do a certain thing, which is not really allowed. So if the Beit Din made a mistake on something, again, which I'm saying is a black and white law, they made a mistake, and people follow them. So now 20 people follow them. Do the 20 different people bring a korban? So the answer is no. In that case, the Beit Din brings a korban, because it's the Beit Din's mistake, and the people did it. Meaning, there are different levels of breaking Shabbat. There is breaking Shabbat b'mezid, on purpose. There's breaking Shabbat b'shogeg. There's breaking Shabbat b'ones, where you're forced to break Shabbat. Where ones fits into all this is interesting. But if the rabbi told you the wrong law, I'm not even going to call it shogeg. It's very possible it's ones. It's almost like you were forced into break. Why are you forced into it? Because you thought he knew what he was talking about. Unfortunately, he didn't know what he was talking about. Certainly the Beit Din, certainly the head Beit Din. So that's very interesting that over here, after the mistake of the leaders, who are the leaders? The Meraglim. The word Eida is used there as well. After they make their mistake, and now the whole community follows along the mistake of the leaders, it's a very interesting law to teach at this point, to say, oh, you know, if the entire people make a mistake based on the leaders need to bring a korban. Which, by the way, I could just imagine somebody raising their hand after Moshe teaches this and saying, listen, with all due respect, if the leaders have the responsibility while we've been punished for 39 years, I'm not answering that question. I'm not even saying it's the same. I'm saying the fact that this law is taught at this particular juncture is interesting, and it opens itself up to this particular law. And I'm going to say it again. And isn't it interesting to teach this law right now? Again, that's what you missed in the very beginning. I'm saying the laws which are introduced in Bamidbar are very interesting. The laws where they come in terms of the interdispersed in the narrative is very interesting. The fact that right after the Meraglim, we have a law. When you come to the land, you know, which is going to be your inheritance and so on, and I'm putting words in there, then you're going to still bring the wine in the Beit HaMikdash, okay, on your individual korbanot, which you're going to bring. That's very interesting. That you're going to go into the land and you're going to take a separate challah from the bread, that's very interesting. Not just the land, when I bring you into the land, that's very interesting. It means the long-term plans are still in place. And now it brings this other law, which doesn't frame it by saying when you come to the land. So it's, okay, so why is this law being taught over here? But it does speak about mistake of leaders, and therefore the lack of responsibility to the individuals. As I said, I could just imagine somebody sitting in Moshe's class after this was taught, raising his hand, really, I'm not saying with chutzpah. I mean, we know sometimes students ask things with chutzpah, right? Right. But over here, even without asking anything with chutzpah, somebody can ask the question and say, hold it a second. this is just a real interesting law to teach at this particular place. And maybe even it is God's way of saying, listen, you're being punished. That's a consequence. By the way, not all punishments, not all results of sin are punishments. Some results of sins are consequences, which means it's very possible that the consequences, they're not ready to enter into the land yet. That doesn't mean it's a punishment, even though you can argue with me what the verses actually say. Yes. It's still interesting. I'll say, no matter what you say, I'm going to still say it's interesting that this law, right? Do you all notice that this is interesting? This law is taught at this time, yes. So you're agreeing with me. You're agreeing with me then. Yeah, good. So you're right then. Okay. Sure, we would like God to see all of our sins or based upon some kind of mistake and not being deliberate. I mean, yeah. Look, the first thing, you know, you get a good lawyer, the first thing you want to do is to say that there was some kind of misunderstanding and so on. It's also interesting, the words shkaga and mishuga are not so far from one another. Okay, maybe mistaken judgment. I'm not, what do you want from me? It wasn't deliberate over here. I can blame the leaders. Again, when in doubt, blame your rabbis. That's what this is telling you over here. So your homework, there's a whole Gemara on this called the Masechet Horiot. The whole thing is about discussions on this particular law, when the responsibility is individuals, when the responsibility is the leaders. That's your homework for next week. Okay. Horiot. It's a whole book. Horiot. Horiot. Yeah. It's the end of Nezikin. So the whole Gemara, that's the topic of the whole Gemara. By the way, it's not so long. It's only around 13 pages or so. So hope it's not 14. The Yerushalmi and Horiot, I think, is 6 pages. And once a friend of mine who was a firstborn and he said he wanted to learn something that he could make a siyum on Erev Pesach. So I told him, I think Yerushalmi Horiot's the smallest one. It's only 6 pages. So he started learning it all night. And then he told me that I made him that it was actually seven. There was a 7th page. I don't remember what it was, but he thought he had it, and then he saw a whole other page there. But believe me, anybody who can learn the whole Yerushalmi in one night can learn one more page. She's going to ask me afterwards which friend it is, so I'll tell you. Okay. You weren't going to ask me? Okay. After this, the next 2 sections to finish off the parsha is the Mekoshesh, which I have worked hard in the past to try to figure out why the Mekoshesh is introduced at this point, and then it ends up with the Parsha of Tzitzit. Okay, those are that's the rest of the Parsha. So which is interesting, which means we have the whole story of the Meraglim narrative. We have 3 laws introduced, the laws of the wine for the individual's korban, we have the law of separating the challah, we have the law of the responsibility of the leaders, when a mistake is made, the Mekoshesh, the one who gathers the wood on Shabbat, his treatment, and then we have the laws of Tzitzit. And then, as I said, each of these things are interesting, the separation between the narratives, between the Mekoshesh and between the Meraglim, these laws are being taught over here before the Mekoshesh, all that is interesting. The laws of Tzitzit themselves, if you look at Rashi, you'll notice, Lo taturu acharei levavchem acharei nechem, the word lo taturu, not to follow, is the same word which is used, latur et haaretz, to go and to see the land, so there is some kind of connection even between the last law which is taught, and between the first law. Regarding the Mekoshesh, we had in the past we had brought up the issue of which Rabbi Akiva ascribes to, and that is that the Mekoshesh is somebody. Well, he identifies him with Tzlavchad, and then with Tzlavchad. Rabbi Akiva identifies with Tzlavchad, and one of the other rabbis, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Yehuda, says that Akiva, you're going to have to atid latein et adin. You're going to have to pay for this. If the Torah didn't say his name, how can you say his name? Which is the Torah tried to hide it, so why are you saying it? So Tosfot then gives an explanation that, hold it, maybe Rabbi Akiva's of the opinion is that really the Mekoshesh was L'shem Shamayim, that he did what he did with a good intention. Basically, all the people in this generation, back to Shuli's point, all the people in the generation have a life sentence, not a life sentence, they're all going to die in the desert. It's a life sentence, they're all going to die, none of them are going to see the land of Israel, and they give up. They say, what difference does it make? Anything we do doesn't make a difference anymore. Our lives are now meaningless. It doesn't make a difference anymore. So the Mekoshesh goes and breaks Shabbat in front of it. By the way, Mekoshesh, he keeps on doing it. He's not Koshesh. They find him Mekoshesh. They tell him, stop, he keeps on doing it. Mekoshesh. And this is, you're not allowed to break Shabbat, but he keeps on doing it. So why does he do it? He says, no, what we do does make a difference. Matter of fact, if you break Shabbat, you're going to get killed for breaking Shabbat, which, by the way, is a mistake of somebody being incredibly idealistic to the point that he sacrifices his life to teach a lesson, which may be the complete counterbalance of what the Meraglim were, where there's no idealism and maybe completely pragmatic, saying, you know, we're not ready to go on land, we're better off to stay over here, the land is, we got big giants, it's scary, whatever. So you have the complete pragmatism on the one narrative, you have complete idealism on the other narrative, and therefore, by the way, neither is okay, and that's why the tzitzit, at least on a homiletic level, have two different colors, blue and white, which represent two different things. Rabbi Soloveitchik taught that the white represents pure, clear logic, while the blue represents the heavens. The blue represents metalogic. The blue represents the sky, God's throne, things which are up in heaven. And Jews need to have a balance. We need to do certain things which are based upon logic. We need to do certain things which are based upon greater ideological needs. But when you make your tzitzit of, let me, kulo tchelet, which will be brought up later on, within the whole story of Korach, you end up, that's exactly what this Mekoshesh does, and that also ends up being something which is catastrophic. So as I said, the laws which are brought in over here and the narratives, you know, we have a way of trying to deal with them, but it gets us back to the two or three over here, and I'm really going to focus on the two of them. Which two of them? Specifically, the two which are in a sense opposites of one another. The thing which is essentially something which is temple-oriented, when the individual brings the offering and he brings the wine, wine is something which is not necessarily sacred, and you're going to make the wine which is sacred. On the other hand, the bread, which is something which is essentially unsacred, you're going to take a little piece of that and you're going to make it sacred. One is temple-oriented, the other is home-oriented. Right? Okay, good. The Sforno is one of the few commentaries who actually attempts to do what I've tried to lead you towards, and that is, what is the connection between the law and the narrative? So he sets forth the theory, starting with source number two. Lasot reich nichoach, talking about the libations, he says, Hinei ad ha'egil hayad korban reich nichoach bezulat minchat v'nesachim, ki inyan behevel uvenoach of Avraham. Prior to the golden calf, every offering was by definition something which brought reach nichoach, which means was seen as beloved and accepted by God. We don't see in the early stories in Bereshit, either by Hevel or Noach, by Avraham, any time that they bring an offering, we don't find there ever being wine which is put into the offering as well. Nonetheless, we find the divine response that God felt it was a reach nichoach. Okay? So he says, if that's the case, then the wine was not necessarily, at least in Bereshit, but he makes a very interesting place where he draws the line. Also, you don't have it by the Korban Pesach, right? It's also not introduced over there. So he is making the line by the Egel. There's also, by the way, by the foot of Har Sinai, there were Olot and Shlamim which were brought, and as far as I recall, there was also no wine brought over there. So what does he mean, and I'm reading into the Sforno, what does he mean, that Korbanot were a good thing until we messed them up? When did we mess up the Korbanot? We messed it up with the Egel. And there it says, Achlu v'shatu, shtia very often is could be one. We messed up the Korbanot, so now the Korbanot needs something else. Correct. But he says that with the Egel is where it gets. Also in Gan Eden, you can say that they also drank from the wine. That's the kind of fruit that gets you confused between, right, Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra. What gets you confused between Tov V'Ra could also be wine. And you have Noach drinking wine, and you have Lot drinking wine, and we have many alcoholics in our ancestry. Okay. And virtually almost all the time it does not work out well. But that's not the point here. The point over here is the use of wine, which, as you're pointing out, the wine itself is something which has some real negative traits to it. Right. Correct. So I'm saying the fact that now it's being introduced to the korban is interesting. It's combustible, if you want. It causes irrational behavior. And the fact that you're going to bring wine with its irrational behavior and bring it into the korban, that's interesting. Again, it's taking the irrationality and focusing it within the service of God. Okay, that becomes very, very interesting. He then says, "But uvachatam be'egel hitzrich mincha unesachim lalotatamin shehi korban tzibur." That after the egel, it was only introduced by the korban tzibur, by the communal offerings. Umeaz shechatu b'miraglim hitzrich mincha unesachim nachshir gam korban yachid. It was needed by the individual's offering as well. Now, the Sforno's observations about these different times that they're introduced and different types of offerings is correct. Whether there really is a cause and effect is interesting. But what I am pointing out is that the Sforno does ask the right question. He say or make the right observation that the laws introduced at this particular juncture should somehow be connected to the narrative as well. He does the same thing right afterwards with Challah in source 3. Challah terimu truma achar chetam miraglim hitzrich gam hachala laman yiru'uyim shetachol brichat biveitechem kamru veishiruteichem titnu lekohen laniach bricha al beitcha. He says that now, after the sin of the miraglim, we need for the challah to be separated from the bread to bring holiness into the home. By the way, the cause and effect over here is not really clear. Why is this the case? How did the sin of miraglim affect the home necessarily? I mean, all that is missing, but what he's doing, again, he's just making the observation, which we understood without the Sforno, namely that the wine is connected to the Mishkan, Beit HaMikdash, while the challah is connected to the home. As I said, that's interesting. The cause and effect here is not completely clear. He does the similar kind of thing in source number 4 regarding the korban of the leaders, which he understands to be exclusively with Avodah Zarah, and he says, okay, that's something which is going to happen now as a result of the miraglim. You can decide yourselves afterwards if you think it's convincing. Okay, let us get back now to the narrative itself. Within the narrative of the miraglim, and this is something which, as far as I can tell, was missed by all commentaries, so you can take full credit for it afterwards. You can say you were thinking of this and this is what occurred to you. Within the narrative of the miraglim, grapes do make an appearance. Yes. Right. Grapes do make an appearance. It actually makes an appearance perhaps in more than one place. The last thing that Moshe says, and we have this in source 5, Perek Gimel, Moshe asks, "Umah ha'aretz hashmenahi imraza, hayesh ba eitz imayin. Does it have a tree or not? V'tchazaktem u'lakachta mipri ha'aretz. And go and take from the fruit of the land, v'yamim yimei bikurei anavim. And the time frame was the time of the first fruits of the grapes," which means grapes is right there. We're told in the background, it may very well mean when Moshe says, you know, about the eights, I know that you're going to tell me, but grapes don't grow on a tree, grapes grow on a vine. Of course, you're going to have to also tell me biblically if it's considered to be in eights or not. Just because we call it a vine and that a tree is not all that impressive to me, because it's, over here it says, mipri ha'aretz, and specifically anavim, and as you know very well, and this is actually a very funny thing, is because it becomes the symbol for the Ministry of Tourism, a group that did not work out very well, like a totally failed group. Why they would want that as their symbol is quite interesting. In Pasuk Kaf Gimel here, it says, "V'yavod nachal eshkol, v'yichritu misham zmura ve'eshkol anavim echad yesu b'mot b'shnayim u'min rimonim u'min ateinim." So we see that within the narrative over here, which means in terms of the specialness of the land of Israel, one of the unique elements of the land of Israel, which is right there in the previous chapter, or two chapters before, is the element of grapes. And now over here we have a law about wine. So again, I can say that this is just some kind of a coincidence, which I think is less convincing. Or I can say that perhaps maybe there really is some kind of a connection, and that's something that we're still trying to figure out. What exactly is that connection? The Rashbam
in source 6 says, "Vayomim yimei bikurei anavim ze megid hakatuv nei eshkol al anavim shenat lu." I mean, which again is a very obvious observation. That how do I know it was the time of grapes? So you see, right afterwards, when they take the fruits, which fruits do they take? They take the grapes and the rimon and the teinim with them. So now let's go back and let's start thinking. If I'm not mistaken, the grapes or wine and bread have a connection. That's really what I wanted to get to. What is the connection between the two? I told you that it's true that on the Shabbat meal we start with the wine, then we make a motzi, and that, or not just Shabbat, any holiday, which is not an answer. Because now the question will then become, but why do we use these things in our meals? And during the week, we don't necessarily have meals like that. Meaning, eating bread during the week is something which is optional. That's probably better for you than most people think. Right? Yes? They make you happy. Carbs make you happy. Yeah. Are they good for you? It's bad for you? You can say it's bad for you? Go ahead. If you want. I'm happy. No, I'm saying it's probably... But you don't have to eat bread. You don't have to eat bread. And I'm saying a lot of people will eat more bread on Shabbat, less bread during the week. Wine, the same thing. A lot of people won't drink any wine, even on Shabbat. They won't drink wine. They'll use grape juice. But it's interesting that our Shabbat meal does have this focus on bread and on wine. And again, I'm pointing out, okay, these are the two elements which are mentioned over here. So what other connections exist between the two? So there are a couple, so let's try to work them out. First of all, on the baseline, which is going to be the weakest connection of all, which is they both have to do with agriculture, which of course you're going to come back to me and say, that's a terrible answer, because lots of other things have to do with agriculture. Although we are going to be moving into the land of Israel, which is an agricultural society, so therefore being in this situation of the desert, and by the way, consider something. In the desert, the bread that they ate was manna from heaven. Right? There's a machloket, what bracha they made on man. So one of the answers is hamotzi lechem in hashamayim. That's one of the opinions of the bracha that they would make. I know you're going to all tell me, but it tastes whatever you want it to taste like, so you make the bracha whatever it tastes like. But that's a serious question. Where did they get liquids from? What did they drink? So they got drink from the river as well, which is also miraculous. It's interesting. I found a teaching, which is in source 19. You could take a look. I don't know the book that he's referring to. This is Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin. Muva b'sefer dvash l'fi dehoyu to'amim bo ta'am yayin v'kol minei mashkim. V'kmo omam haya lechem malchei asharet ochlim kacha be'er mashke shel malchei asharet shotin. So it's claiming that there was a direct parallel between the man and the be'er. The man tastes like whatever you wanted to taste like. It says that the be'er tasted like fine wine. That you wanted this to taste like fine wine. You had Rothschild, 1976, coming out of the Be'er. But again, and it's saying it's the wine or the drink of angels. Because again, you'll tell me, but angels don't necessarily eat or drink. But it's saying, no, it's something which really is divine and something which really comes from heaven. But that's exactly the point, that these are both based upon miracles. And being that they're both based on miracles, there is absolutely no human involvement in it, which means the Be'er is something which comes from God, the Man is something which comes from God. It's very clear these things come from God. It's something which is very clear, it comes to the whole meat thing was a lie. It's something which is very clear that there's a God element to it, but the human element is something which is lacking. On the other hand, and this is what's special about agriculture, you have a total partnership between man and God, which means agriculture is interesting because you take something, but by the way, for the most part, you take something which looks like it's dead and you put it in the ground and it comes back to life. Agriculture, there's no question in my mind, is a metaphor for resurrection. It's a metaphor for tchiyat ha-meitim. You take something dead, you put it in the ground, and suddenly it comes back to life. And keeping this in mind, let me just read to you a couple of sources, and then I'll take your some questions and comments. Look at source number, oh, it's not even numbered, 6.5. It's the Gemara in Shabbat. Amar Reish Lakish, Mai Dichtiv, what does it mean, the verse in Yeshayahu? V'hayu emunat itecha choson yeshuot chachma v'dat. So there are six different things mentioned in that verse in Yeshayahu. So the Gemara over here is going to tell us, Reish Lakish is teaching, that these six different things represent the six different parts of Mishnah. Therefore, emunot is seder zra'im. Itecha, which means times, is seder mo'ed. Chosen is seder nashim. Yeshuot seder nizikin. Chachmot seder kachim. Vidat seder taharot. Why each one of these things is connected, lots of commentaries will discuss. But what's interesting, what is connected to agriculture, to zra'im? Emunot. Rashi writes, Seder Zra'im, She'al emunot ha'adam somech lafrish ma'asrotav kira'ui. Very interesting. Rashi says, where's the emunah? Not what I would have said. Rashi says, where's the emunah? That the farmer, after he works really hard, will have the faith to separate ma'aser, to separate a tenth, and to give it off to charity, rather than, and have faith.
What to separate, that's the point.
And to have what to separate. The Tosfot here quotes Yerushalmi, which, as far as I can tell, is a phantom Yerushalmi. I say phantom Yerushalmi because sometimes when Rishonim quote Yerushalmis, they're not there. As far as I can tell, this is one of them that's not, in fact, there. It could be that they were quoting it from a klisheni, this, or somebody else quoted, but they didn't see it themselves. Or it could be they don't mean Yerushalmi as the Talmud Yerushalmi, but rather a collection of midrashim, or teachings, that came from Eretz Yisrael, which is most likely the case over here. Okay, I'm just telling you that this happens often. He quotes in the Yerushalmi, Emunot Zesedi Zraim, source number 8, Mefereish B'Yerushalmi Shema Amin B'Chayi Olamim V'Zareya. He believes in God and he plants, which means he realizes that there's a partnership. If there's too much rain, not enough rain, not rain at the right time, which means you have a partner involved in your planting, and that partner is going to have to provide also, although it's not going to work. By the way, this phantom Yerushalmi is found in source number 9, which is in Midrash and Tehillim, just if you're looking for it. There's a famous book which is called the Shev Shmaitita. It's a book which is a classic in terms of later rabbinic thinking, in terms of discussions on things which, the best way of describing them is halachic mathematics. I know that made no sense by itself, but how the law of Rove works, majority, how a Suffolk works, Fake-Sfeika works, he explains all kinds of situations of doubt and of questions, which really come down to sometimes to mathematical issues, and it's considered to be a classic. He writes over here, which exactly what I was thinking, which is why we dug him up. In his introduction, he writes in Source 10, V'katvu atosot b'shem Yerushalmi, Shema'amin b'chaye olamim v'zareya v'haynu she'enu ka'oskim b'masa u'matan v'omrim kochi v'otzim yadi. Not like the person who's involved in business, who says, okay, this is totally up to me. Ki im zareya mashlich zerotav yishaded admato v'yichasem sham yavdo yafsidu v'yirkavu. You plant something in the ground is basically burying it. Ad yirachem Hashem, till God has compassion, alav, yorid tlalim, which, by the way, the word tal, do, is always used in the connection, the Gemara, with resurrection. Tal is always used. And God puts tal on it, yeshiv haruach, and the spirit comes back, birina yiktsar, right, birina yiktsaru, birina yiktsar v'yisa amunatav, as you recognize from the Shir HaMalot, which basically he's describing this as I would have in terms of a resurrection. So again, this is not good enough. Why is this not good enough? Well, it is good. It's just not good enough. Which means, if the Jewish people had a lack of faith, why do I say the lack of faith? Because when the Meraglim come, they don't want to go into the land. So now what does the discussion become? Okay, you're staying in the desert for a while, but what do we begin to speak about? Agricultural laws. So laws of agriculture, which by definition deal with faith, the definition, you know, in terms of the rain, in terms of the planting, resurrection, which means basic ideas of faith are communicated by
agriculture, that becomes a real good focus. By the way, again, everything I just now said is true, and it's right, and it's good. You don't have to go any further, but it's not good enough. Why is it not good enough? Because we still have to focus specifically on wine and on bread, why these things are being introduced. Yes? Wine, let me just interject. Let me interject for 1 second, then you'll continue. Wine was drunk in ancient times, depending on location, but because they had no water. I mean, water was very difficult in many places, so therefore you were able to take it, and you were able to store it for a longer period of time. But some places, beer, you know, vodka, wine, and other things, because they stayed without refrigeration. So wine was certainly used. There's still another element I'm looking for, yeah? Perfect. That's what I was looking for. Both wine and bread are not simple foods. They're complex foods. I'm not talking about their vitamins and things like that. I don't know anything about that. Well, I suspect some of you do. What is true, though, about wine and bread is that there are certain things you just pick from the tree, or you just pull out of the ground, and you eat. Both of these, just like agriculture, has a very strong God element in them. Both wine and bread have a very strong human element in them, which means it's humans taking something which grows and improving it, taking it and being involved with it. Now, that itself, I think, is an incredible in terms of a metaphor. By the way, there's a halachic implication of this that we'll see in a second. What's the matter? But the... What? You're improving what... You're improving God's basic... I can look... You're processing. Meaning, I can look, and you know, some of the discussions that took place in antiquity regarding circumcision. I could say the human body is perfect. It's created from God. The human body is perfect, created God. How dare we make, quote-unquote, improvements on it? Actually, one of my students asked me if I would discuss something which we discussed here a couple of years ago. I have a class of contemporary halachic issues. He wants me to discuss this week cosmetic surgery. So again, the question comes up with the cosmetic surgery. God created a certain way. How dare we go and try to change or improve on it? Do we have a right to do such a thing? Now, if anybody says that we have no right to improve on the body anyway, so then how can you do circumcision? Of course, your response could be, okay, that God commanded you to do, but still, you were told to do. But nonetheless, if what God creates is perfect, then what right do we have to do make any changes on it? But I'll say again, is that no, ultimately this world is a partnership between man and God. And therefore, the partnership between man and God actually comes to fruition on a higher level in bread and in wine than it does in an apple, which I pull directly off the tree. Which means the apple that comes directly off the tree is something which again, you could tell me that man planted it, you could say God planted it, I mean, that is of less concern. But over here, the processing is what's interesting. The process is in turning it into something which is more complex. And that's where it's not, again, I want to go back again and say, over here there is this partnership, and that is a very interesting metaphor to talk to a generation who, you know, basically question God's being with them and question God's involvement, and now God is calling them back in and saying, not only am I involved, no, but ultimately what I'm looking for is not for me to bring you and not for you to do all, not for me to do all, for you to do all, basically for this relationship to work, as many relationships need to work, what do we need? We need there to be a partnership. And over here, within the bread and within the wine, we actually have what I think is a wonderful expression of this partnership. Now, as I said, to prove this point in terms of halacha, and we always want to do that as well, in source 12, and we could have found this in many places, it's just, he said it in a short line. Elema shekoveya bracha pratit la'atzmo, shemaskirin oto bracha, kimo yayin, shomrim hagefen, uprat, shomrim birchat lechem. Which means, on a the Tzlach is the commentary of the Noda Behuda on the Gemara. Now, as I said, I could have found this quote in lots of different places, but this was the most succinct place. Ostensibly, okay, let's take away it ostensibly. What bracha do I make on apple juice? Shakol. What bracha do I make on orange juice? Shakol. What bracha should I therefore make on grape juice? Shakol. Nonetheless, what do we find? That somehow grapes, certainly when grapes ferment, somehow it gets its own bracha, it becomes bori pri agafen. Okay, what happened? What bracha should I make on wheat that I take out of the ground? So it should be an adama, right? The only problem is wheat out of the ground is not really edible,
So therefore, it doesn't even have an adama, because to get an adama, it needs to be the purpose of what it was grown for. I'm sorry for getting too complicated here. So wheat right out of the ground would actually be a shakol, because in order to make an adama, it has to be its purpose, what you grow it for. So therefore, there's a whole question with onions, by the way, in the Middle Ages, whether you'd make an adama or a shakol on the onions. You'll find books saying, no, you only make a shakol on an onion, because nobody ate onions. Nobody ate raw onions in those days. People wouldn't eat onions that were raw, so they said the bracha is a shakol. Somebody does eat it raw, the bracha is a shakol. So you're going to tell me, you know, a lot of people who would eat onions that are raw, so therefore it's an adama. Why? Because to have a bracha of adama is to be the purpose of what it's grown for. Wheat is not grown in order to eat it in its pure form. So if you take wheat and you toast it, right, and you make granola out of it, so then the bracha would be ha'adama. At which point does it get another, whole other bracha? It gets a mizonot, at which point, when it has starch in it, right? And now you have to think, now what kind of way do you use wheat in order that, but the starch comes out of it. So generally, the best way of doing that is actually to do it in a pot. And you have, okay, let's say you take one of the five grains and you cook it in a pot and you have, you know, some kind of, you know, an oat cereal or something that you would eat. Right, so now you have mizonot. Now the same thing is if you grind it down and you bake it, you'll also end up having mizonot, which means over here the bracha actually changed because there's a higher level of usage, which is considered to be mizonot, which is that it's filling, which is actually in terms of its result. It fills you up, or I mean mizonot, it fills you up. Because it fills you up, it gets its whole another bracha. Granola doesn't fill you up. It's basically bird food. So therefore, that it's edible, but that would be an adama. But for some reason, bread achieves a whole nother level, because bread, again, seems to be this whole other point of this human and divine partnership, which is what I'm getting back to again, and bread which is made becomes hamotzi lechem in haaretz. Now, as I said, that is just something which is very interesting, and the bracha of the wine and the bracha of the bread, which goes back to this human-God partnership, doesn't that become interesting that when we start our Shabbat or our holiday meals, we hereby start with our bread and our wine, which is not just plain, uncomplicated food. It's more complex food, which required this human involvement, again, this human-God involvement, and now we have something which is on a higher level. Did all that make sense? I can stop already, or should I go further? What do you mean different level? The people who went at the end,
yeah,
right, they went because they said, oh no, we are going to go, but Moshe says, then God's not with you. Remember, say, by the way, that's exactly the point. God is not with you. To go in, God needs to be with you. To go into the land of Israel, you need there to be a partnership. If God is not with you, there's no partnership, it's not going to work. But I'm going to say again now that both wine and bread represent this partnership between man and God. Right? By man saying, you know, we're not going in because we don't trust in God, and realize that God is with us, that's not enough. That's what the Meraglim basically do. Don't realize that God is with them. The others who say, no, we are going to go. We can do it ourselves. No, you can't do it yourselves. There needs to be a partnership between man and God, and that's how we enter the land. And that's what both of these foods actually represent. No, when Moshe says no, they have no merit at all. Moshe says no, don't go. Again, it goes almost back to the Mekoshesh, somebody having too much faith. Oh no, it's going to work out. No, Moshe says it's not going to work out. You don't do it. There is one narrative in the Torah that brings together bread and wine. Wine is not there with Pesach. Wine is not there in Pesach. It is. Is there wine there?
I don't know.
There are those who make reference to that, and just assume that he must have served them. Yeah, in Source 18, Yismach Yisrael, he says that he says it must be that he served them wine. I'm not reading 18 now. I'm just saying for you that Avram served wine and bread. The section is really the section of Yosef, and the Sar HaMashkim and the Sar HaOfim. Yeah, in Source 15, yeah. So you have Yosef in prison, and we have the steward in charge of wine and the steward in charge of bread. And of course, you know, one has a dream, and the dream has to do with grapes, and so on. And what's interesting is
redemption comes. By the way, also, if I'm going to skip a second, at source 16, right afterwards, you have the Sarah Mashkim, who is one of the leaders, who says, Et chatotai maskir hayom, a leader who sins, a leader who makes a mistake, which is also thematically connected to our section, which was that next part, in terms of leaders who make a mistake. So the whole question then, as I said, I noticed this connection, and now the question was how to try to nuance it. Look, one thing about wine, and that's articulated by the Al-Sheikh in Source 17, but it's also the Gemaras that say this black and white, is that wine brings about comfort. The Gemara asks, why did God create wine? He says, to bring about comfort for mourners. As a cure for depression. Of course, you're going to tell me that wine is a depressant itself, but it says, no, God created grapes in the world. Somebody could say, why did God create marijuana? So for people who, no, for people who, for medicinal purposes. But the Gemara asked that, why create wine? Wine creates confusion, wine creates sin, all the terrible things he wanted to tell me before about Noah and Lashon Hara got Lot. By the Lashon Hara, it's true. All these terrible things. You're right. So then why did God create it? It says, because when people are mourning, sometimes you need a little bit of wine in order to help you get through the day. And again, it's a very interesting comment that the Gemara would say such a thing. Yosef is in prison. The one who gives him hope is actually the Sarah Mashkim. And Yosef places his hope. But it's also interesting that the way the narrative works out, even though that Yosef puts his hope, he still remains in prison. Which means in front of him are the Sarah Mashkim and the Sarah Ofoth, representing the bread and the wine. And what ends up happening? Yosef does stay there longer. And why? Because he didn't put his faith in God. That's exactly what we're told over there by Rashi, which I think is very difficult. Because I think that if you have a way to get out of prison, you try to get out of prison. Rashi nonetheless feels that he should bring this midrash, that he didn't remember Yosef. He forgets him. Why? Because Yosef should have put his faith in God and not his faith within man. So again, I'm always troubled by that. But now I'm not as troubled as I usually am by this. Because ultimately, when I go back and I think about bread and wine, I realize that bread and wine is this partnership. Don't put all your faith in man, but you need both. Which means what Yosef should have done is he should have asked him and then say Tehillim every day, which means, and then Daven every day, which means there still needs to be this combination between the two. But Yosef does remain in prison afterwards and does remain there a while, but at the end he does get out. So therefore, the representative of the bread and the wine in the Yosef story, which is there, but at the end there will be an end of the story, I think is an interesting parallel. So over here, the Jews are stuck in the desert. They're stuck because of a lack of faith. Again, which goes exactly back to that reading of the Yosef story that Rashi has. They're going to be stuck here for a while, but at the end of the day, what's going to happen? You are going to get to the land of Israel. You are going to leave. There will be a partnership with God. There will be a partnership in creating fine wine. There will be a partnership in creating bread. That partnership is ultimately what living in the land of Israel is going to be about. Right? It says it. That's exactly what it quotes. No, but too much. No, but it's interesting in terms of when a lot of the reason why you would think that an Avil can't drink wine is because in the 9 days we're not supposed to drink wine. Right? So it says that no, that God created this in order to take mourners out of total depression to the point that you give up. So over here they may not have had wine in the desert, even though they had the Be'er that tasted like wine. I don't know if it had the same impact, but even the discussing of the wine perhaps was enough to take them out of this depression of being stuck in the desert. But ultimately, the issue over here is that wine and bread represent a high form of agriculture because it represents the highest form of the human involvement within agriculture. Agriculture at its very basic level represents faith. But this is more than just faith. This is faith together with humans using their skills in this partnership, and that's ultimately what the land of Israel is going to be about. It's faith in God on the one hand and man acting on the other hand, man taking the natural resources and using them in the highest possible way. And that is what being in the land is, and that's, I think, why this discussion comes up immediately after the Meraglim, to give them faith, to focus them forward, but that's why specifically these elements are used.
That's why they have it at a wedding.
That's why they have it at a wedding also.